I want to briefly introduce you to each of the gospel writers and their purpose for writing. And I want to do this in some detail because this is the foundation of our faith. Jesus Christ is our faith. And the information we have of him comes from the gospel accounts.
Welcome to The Word Unleashed with Tom Pennington. Tom is pastor teacher at Countryside Bible Church in Southlake, Texas. Hello, I'm Bill Wright. Today we continue in Tom's series titled, An Aerial View of the New Testament. Why do the four Gospels often differ in their content and emphasis as it relates to Jesus Christ? Well, that's a question many believers wonder about. Here's what's crucial to understand. Each gospel writer describes Christ's person and work, but they do so with distinct purposes. These clear differences don't detract from Jesus and the good news of salvation. Rather, they show this powerful message from different angles. Today on The Word Unleashed, Pastor Tom reveals the uniqueness of all four gospels and why these distinctions actually strengthen our faith. Let's join Tom for more now. Here on The Word Unleashed.
The audience for Matthew was the Jewish people. A number of the early church fathers testify that it was written for Jewish believers living in the land of Palestine. Origen, for example, says it was prepared for the converts from Judaism. Eusebius says Matthew, who had at first preached to the Hebrews, when he was about to go to other people, committed his gospel to writing in his native tongue and thus compensated those whom he was obliged to leave for the loss of his presence. Why did he write? If he was writing to the Jewish people, what was his purpose for writing? His purpose was to present Jesus as the Messiah and her King. Or we could put it differently, to present Jesus as the fulfillment of the messianic promise and the rightful heir to the throne of David. Matthew quotes more than 60 Old Testament prophecies to show that Christ is the fulfillment of all of those Old Testament promises. So Matthew, writing to a Jewish audience, uses the Old Testament to prove that Jesus is her Messiah and her King. Let's move on to Mark. Mark's name doesn't appear within the book itself, but the unanimous testimony of the early church was that Mark was in fact the author. Again, we have evidence that he wrote this book from Papias. His evidence came directly from the Apostle John, he claims. He says that Mark was an interpreter of Peter, that he wrote down accurately, though not in exact order, the things that Christ did and said. You'll see this theme of Mark being an interpreter for Peter over and over again. Justin Martyr says Mark wrote the memoirs of Peter. Irenaeus, Peter and Paul went to Rome to preach the gospel, and after their exodus, and we don't know exactly what that means, Mark preserved what Peter preached. Clement of Alexandria, again, you'll notice that all of these are very soon after the death of the apostles, says that after Peter had preached in Rome, those who heard him asked Mark to write out the messages, and that's what you have in the Gospel of Mark. Tertullian simply said that Mark's gospel was in fact Peter's gospel. In other words, John Mark was a sort of amanuensis of sorts for the apostle Peter. Origen, Mark wrote his gospel as Peter guided him. So over and over again, you come up with the conclusion that from the earliest days of the church, Mark was accepted as the author of the second gospel. He was a close companion of Peter, and he received his material from Peter and was directed by what Peter instructed him. A brief biography of this young man. He's called John Mark, John whose surname was Mark. He was not a disciple, but he was completely acquainted with many of the activities from the life of Christ. It's possible Peter led him to Christ. He calls him in 1 Peter 5, my son. He's a cousin of Barnabas. His home in Jerusalem was a center of church activity. He accompanied Paul and Barnabas on their first missionary journey. But you remember, he went with them, but he quickly returned home. And when it came time for the second journey, that became a real source of conflict. Because on the second missionary journey, Barnabas determined to take John Mark again, and there was a sharp disagreement between them so that they parted ways. Paul took Silas and Barnabas took John Mark. But apparently, there was a reconciliation between Paul and Mark, because in two other New Testament passages, Paul refers to Mark as his helper, his fellow worker, in Colossians 4 and in Philemon verse 24. It's possible that Mark remained in Rome after Paul left and joined with Peter when he arrived. He's last mentioned, and I love this. After all of that that happened in the life of Paul, Paul finds himself in his second Roman imprisonment, facing death. He's going to be executed soon. He ends his last New Testament letter, 2 Timothy 4:11, with these words, "Only Luke is with me. Pick up Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for service." So here was a young man who struggled, didn't start out well, but who by God's grace ended well. And we have a gospel under the inspiration of the Spirit written by him. When did he write? Well, we can't be absolutely certain, but it was probably in the 50s A.D. To whom did he write? Well, he wrote to the Romans. And we know that for a number of reasons. Matthew wrote to the Jewish Christians. Mark wrote to a Roman audience. And there are a number of ways we know that. First of all, there are more Latin expressions that he uses instead of Greek ones. He translates Aramaic expressions. Now remember, Aramaic was spoken by the Jews in Palestine, but he translates it into Greek to make sure they understand it. He wouldn't have needed to do that if he was writing to a Jewish audience that spoke Aramaic. He omits a number of Jewish elements and makes very few references to the Old Testament. He also uses the Roman system of time as he writes his gospel. And it's interesting, at the crucifixion, he identifies Simon, the one who bore the cross for Christ, as the father of Alexander and Rufus, possibly for the benefit of Roman Christians, because they're referred to at the end of the book of Romans, Romans 16:13. He explains things that no Jew would need explained to him, so he's obviously not writing to the Jews. And it's interesting, because he's writing to the Romans, you know, Romans, they didn't care where you were from, what your background was. What they wanted to know is, were you a person that could get things done? So there's no genealogy in Mark. The Romans didn't care about your genealogy. They wanted to know, what could you do? And so the Gospel of Mark is a gospel of action. And in fact, 41 times in the Gospel of Mark, you find the word immediately. Jesus doing something again and again, immediately. More than the other Gospels combined. And so Mark is giving us this sense of energy in the life of Christ. What was his purpose? Well, the key verse is Mark 10:45. "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." Jesus is presented to the Romans as the servant of the Lord, who is also the Son of God. It begins that way in Mark's Gospel, chapter 1, verse 1. D. Edmund Hebert writes, "What he did proved who he was." That's how Mark writes. What Jesus did proved who he was. What he wrought authenticated what he taught. And so Mark constantly tells you what Jesus did as the servant, as the slave of the Lord. And as the servant of the Lord suffered, so the Roman Christians, the slaves of Christ now, to whom this gospel was written, could find comfort in their suffering as they read it. Let's move on to the Gospel of Luke. How do we know Luke wrote Luke's gospel? Well, first of all, look at the external evidence, and I won't go through all of this, but again, you see from early church history an overwhelming weight of evidence. The Maturian fragment represents the views of those who were in Rome. The third book of the Gospels, it says, Luke compiled in his own name. Irenaeus says, Luke put down in his book the gospel which Paul preached. And by the way, he quotes almost every chapter of Luke in his writings, writing in the 100s A.D. Tertullian says that Matthew and John were written by apostles, and the other two gospels were written by companions of the apostles. And the reading of the gospel of Luke is an established practice in the churches. Origen, the third gospel according to Luke, was written for the converts from the Gentiles. So the testimony of the early church was absolutely unanimous. But you also can see this evidence internally. The way you argue for who wrote Luke is by going to Acts, because they were written by the same person. We went here and we did this. What that implies is that the author was one of Paul's traveling companions on his journey. The rest of the book was written by the author of the we section, same vocabulary and style. So you rule out everybody but Luke. The author of Acts and the third gospel are the same. You can look at the vocabulary and know that. So you see how you reason backward to Luke, and the medical language of Luke and Acts may confirm that Luke was the writer. Let me give you a brief biography of Luke. The Greek is Lucas, probably an abbreviation of Lucanus. He only appears three times by name in the New Testament. He, of course, permeates the book of Acts in those we passages. He's a Gentile. Paul makes that clear in Colossians. That means, except for Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 4, he's the only Gentile author of Scripture. He was well-educated in the Greek culture and language. Most believe that he was from Syrian Antioch. He joins Paul on his second missionary journey and stays in Philippi until Paul comes through on the third journey. After that, they travel everywhere together. He was a physician by profession, Colossians 4:14 says. What's interesting is that in the ancient world, there were three educational centers. There was Athens, Alexandria, Egypt, and Tarsus, where Paul grew up. We can't prove this, but many hypothesize, and it's possible, that Luke and Paul met while Luke was attending university in Tarsus. In 2 Timothy, Paul identifies Luke as his only companion during his second and final imprisonment before his execution, faithful to the end. And a Latin writer claims that Luke never married. He was married to the gospel ministry, and he died at the age of 74. Again, we can't be sure of that. He wrote probably in 60 to 61 AD. He may have researched his book during the 2 years in Caesarea that Paul was imprisoned there in 57 to 59 AD, and then wrote the book during Paul's first Roman imprisonment when they finally made it to Rome, as you read at the end of Acts, in 60 to 62 AD. Luke does things that the other gospel writers don't do. He consistently shows the wider implications of the gospel of Christ to the Gentiles. You get little clues of this throughout his book. For example, the angel's message at the birth of Christ is to everybody, to all men. Simeon foretells that Christ is going to be a light for the Gentiles. You remember when Jesus as a baby is brought to the temple? All flesh is to see the salvation of God. The Great Commission is to all the nations. And so you see this sort of emphasis. He also takes a special interest in social outcasts. He presents stories that aren't in other gospels. The immoral woman of chapter 7, the transformation of Zacchaeus in chapter 19, the robber and his repentance on the cross, the thief in chapter 23, the prodigal in chapter 16, the publican, and that should be 15, the publican in chapter 18, the Samaritans are represented as being equal to the Jews. These are very uncommon things, but he was a Gentile writing to Gentiles. He also elevates the role of women in an amazing way. Women are mentioned 43 times in his gospel, only 49 times in Matthew and Mark combined. He presents, for example, Christ's birth from Mary's perspective. It's the only gospel writer that does. Matthew does from Joseph's perspective. And he has these other women figures. Women figure prominently at the birth of Christ and in the resurrection narratives. So Luke's target audience is much broader than Matthew's. It's Gentile, it's Greek, it's men and women, and it crosses all socioeconomic groups. But why did he write? Turn with me to Luke chapter 1, because Luke tells us exactly why he wrote. We don't have to guess in his case. He explains it very clearly. Luke chapter 1, verse 1. He says, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us," there have been other accounts, he said, "just as they were handed down to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word," that's apostles. So he says, the apostles handed down to us information, many have written accounts, "but for me," verse 3, "it seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning." Luke is a historian. He investigated everything, and he decided to write it out for you in consecutive order, "most excellent Theophilus." We don't know who this man was. We know that this book and Acts were written to the same person. Most excellent is a title that's used in the book of Acts for Roman officials. It's very possible this man was one of those who came to faith even in Caesar's household. We don't know, and there's a lot of conjecture. But he was a Greek, we can tell by his name, and he receives this account, verse 4, so that, here we go, here's the reason, in order that you may know the exact truth about the things you have been catechized in, is literally what it says. You have been taught the truth, and now I'm going to give it to you in consecutive order. I've researched it carefully. Here is the information you have been taught. That's Luke's purpose. He is presenting a historical reference to Christ. But he emphasizes in presenting that historical record the perfect humanity of Jesus Christ. He does that in a variety of ways. In the genealogy, for example, Matthew just goes back to Abraham, which the Jews would be interested in. Luke goes back to Adam. He provides more information on the humanity of Christ than any of the other gospel records. On the birth, that's the longest account. That's why we always read it at Christmas time. The infancy, he gives us more information on the infancy and youth of Christ than any other writer. The normal human development, all of those things are unusual. More than any other writer, he presents Christ as the perfect man. Christ has a hometown. He shared common social life in a number of passages in Luke. Luke wants his Greek readers to see Christ as the perfect ideal man, which the Greeks were always looking for. Jesus was the answer to that pursuit. That brings us to the Gospel of John. Very interesting to compare John with the synoptics. Get used to the word synoptics. It's a word that simply means to see together. It speaks of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Those are the synoptic gospels because they have much of the same material. Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John is the odd man out. When you compare them, you have several interesting comparisons. The synoptics emphasize the humanity of Christ. John, the deity of Christ. The synoptics begin with the human genealogy, or at least human relationships. The Gospel of John begins with a divine relationship. The Word was with God. The Word was God. The synoptics record the public discourses. The Gospel of John, primarily private discourses. So there's some interesting comparisons in John and the synoptics. We know that John wrote this gospel through a stream of external evidence. It was universally accepted by the entire church. Eusebius, writing in 325, says his gospel must be acknowledged as genuine. The writings of John have been accepted without dispute both now and in ancient times. Irenaeus names John as the author of the book. By the way, Irenaeus informs us that John lived in the region of Ephesus until the time of Emperor Trajan, near the end of the first century. And Irenaeus, here's what's interesting to me, Irenaeus says that he had known Polycarp and insisted that he could recall the teachings of Polycarp. Now, why is that important? Because Polycarp was a disciple, a personal disciple of the Apostle John. Polycarp had been a Christian for 86 years when he was martyred in 155, and he frequently reminisced about his conversations with the Apostle John and with others who had actually seen the Lord. So he was a tie to Irenaeus. So a number of other references that lead us to support externally John as the author. But internally we can see it as well. The fourth gospel is anonymous. That is, it doesn't say that John wrote it, but there is sufficient evidence inside the book of John to know that he's the author. This is a line of evidence that was presented originally by B.F. Westcott, Bishop Westcott, and most today writing about John take this line of argument. It's clear the author was Jewish by what he says and what he writes. He was a Palestinian Jew because he knows the details of Palestine. He was an eyewitness. You have little details like the name of the high priest servant who lost his ear. You remember when Peter got a little rambunctious, the arrest. The author was an apostle. He was a member of the inner circle, and here's what's very interesting. In the synoptics, the inner circle is three people. Who are they? Peter, James, and John. In John, John is never mentioned by name. That's odd, don't you think? But notice the end of John. Flip over to John 21. John 21. Look at verse 20. You remember this little encounter after the resurrection? Peter turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who had leaned back on his bosom at the supper. So he was in that intimate circle with Christ and said, "Lord, who is the one who betrays you?" So Peter, seeing him, seeing this disciple whom Jesus loved, said to Jesus, "Lord, what about this guy?" Jesus said, "What if I want him to remain until I come? What is that to you? You follow me." That's his story, not your story. Therefore, this saying went out among the brethren that this disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but only, "If I want him to remain till I come, what is that to you? This is the disciple who is testifying to these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true." So it's very clear that the one whom Jesus especially loved in that inner circle, who was next to Christ at the Last Supper, is the one who wrote this fourth gospel. So the gospel had to be written by the apostle John. Who was this man? We know he was a fisherman. We know that he was from a fairly wealthy family since his father had servants. We know that he was a follower of John the Baptist and was pointed to Jesus by John. Jesus chose him as one of the 12 and as one of the inner circle. He was the youngest disciple. Peter, the oldest. We know that he was banished to Patmos, according to Revelation 1, because of his testimony of faith in Christ. According to tradition, he later returned to Ephesus, where he spent the rest of his life, and died around the end of the first century. When did he write his gospel? Well, we have no evidence to absolutely determine it, but we know when he lived, and we know that he wrote after the other gospels, so we have a window of 70 AD to 98 AD. Most would say it was in the 90s AD when this gospel was written. He wrote, unlike Matthew to the Jews, unlike Mark to the Romans, Luke to the Greeks, he wrote to the entire world. What was his purpose? I love the Gospel of John. Leon Morris says, "The fourth gospel is a pool in which a child can wade and an elephant can swim." Hebert says, "This striking character is something which the simplest reader is conscious of, yet the ablest scholar cannot fully explain." He wrote his letter at the request of the Ephesian elders, we're told in church history. And he wrote partially to preserve the unique stories from the life of Christ. This is interesting. Matthew has approximately 35% unique material that's unique to him, not in the other Gospels. Mark, 7%. Luke, about 50%. John has 93% unique material. In fact, he deliberately chose material that was not in the Synoptic Gospels, even though they'd already been written and he was familiar with them. Prior to the Passion Week, there are only two incidents that he mentions that are in the other three Gospels: the feeding of the 5,000 and the walking on the water. John includes no more than 20 days from the entire life of Jesus Christ. And seven chapters of his gospel, chapters 13 to 19, are for one 24-hour period. It's very clear that John wrote with one specific purpose, and he chose carefully the events that he wanted to include. He tells us why he wrote his gospel. In John 20, verse 30, "Therefore many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written in order that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name." John says, "I'm writing really with two purposes. One, to strengthen the faith that you already have in Jesus as the Messiah and the Son of God, and that believing in him you can have life in his name. And evangelistically, I'm writing to those who have not believed that you would come to embrace these realities." That's why I often refer people to the Gospel of John who say they aren't believers, because John makes it clear that unlike the other Gospels that were primarily written to believers, he wrote to unbelievers. So when you step back and you look at the four Gospels, this is what you get. Matthew to Jewish believers representing Jesus as Messiah and King. Mark to the Roman, probably believers and other Gentiles, Jesus as servant. Luke to the Greeks, believing Greeks and other Gentiles, Jesus as the perfect man. And John to the entire world, Jesus as the unique Son of God. You see how God raised up these four men from totally different backgrounds, writing with totally different purposes in mind to give us different facets of the wonder and beauty and glory of Jesus Christ.
That's Tom Pennington here on The Word Unleashed with part two of his series, An Aerial View of the New Testament. Tom will have part three for you next time, and we do hope you'll join us then. Does your church follow cultural trends instead of biblical standards for leadership in the church? In his book, Christ's Plan for the Church, Tom Pennington outlines and explains from Ephesians 4 that Christ has given instructions for the leadership, structure, and growth of his church. Purchase your copy of Christ's Plan for the Church today at thewordunleashed.org. The Word Unleashed is made possible because of the prayers and financial gifts of individuals like you. Please consider partnering with us. You can find out how to do so by visiting us online at The Word Unleashed. And now for Tom Pennington and the entire team, I'm Bill Wright. Thanks for listening to The Word Unleashed, exalting God's glory, explaining God's truth.